Well, I don't know. Just call me stupid then. No, 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 a woman in a shawl yelled. Don't you dare use that word in here. That's right, Loretta, the young man added. No one here is stupid. Sometimes we get a little confused, that's all.
Stupid, stupid, stupid,
Anna muttered under her breath as if she was cursing. She gave Loretta the evil eye.
Stupid.
Patel did not seem perturbed. He quietly led Ruth and Art out of the room and to an elevator. As they ascended, he spoke. To answer your question, most of the residents are what we call frail elderly. They may have problems seeing or hearing or getting around without a cane or a walker. Some are sharper than you or I. Others are easily confused and have signs of dementia due to Alzheimer's or what have you. They tend to be a little forgetful about taking the pills, which is why we dispense all medications. But they always know what day it is, whether it's Movie Sunday or herb-picking Monday. And if they don't remember the year, why should they? Some notions of time are irrelevant.
We might as well tell you now, Art said. Mrs. Young thinks she's coming here because of a radon leak in her home.
He presented a copy of the letter he had created.
That's a new one, Patel conceded with an appreciative chuckle. I'll keep that in mind for other family members whose parents need a nudge. Ah, yes, free rent, courtesy of the California Department of Public Safety. Quite good to make it official, mock of authority like a summons.
He swung open a door.
This is the unit that just became available.
They walked into an apartment overlooking the gardens, a compact living room, bedroom, and bathroom, empty of furnishings, smelling of fresh paint and new carpets. It occurred to Ruth that what Patel meant by just became available was that the last resident had died. The cheeriness of the place now seemed ominous, a facade hiding a darker truth.
This is one of the nicest units, Patel said. There are smaller, less expensive rooms, studios, and some without an ocean or garden view. We should have one of those available, in about another month.
My God, he expected someone to die soon, and he said it so casually, so matter-of-factly. Ruth felt trapped, frantic to escape. This place was like a death sentence. Wouldn't her mother feel the same way? She'd never stay here for a month, let alone three.
We can provide the furniture at no extra charge, Patel said. But usually the residents like to bring their own things, personalize it, and make it their home. We encourage that. And each floor is assigned the same staff, two caretakers per floor, day and night. Everyone knows them by name. One of them even speaks Chinese.
Cantonese or Mandarin? Ruth asked.
That's a good question.
He pulled out a digital recorder and spoke into it. Find out if Janie speaks Cantonese or Mandarin. By the way, Ruth asked, how much are the fees? Patel answered without hesitation.
$3,200 to $3,800 a month, depending on the room and level of services needed. That includes an escort to a monthly medical appointment. I can show you a detailed schedule downstairs.
Ruth couldn't help from gasping over the cost.
Did you know that? She asked Art.
He nodded. She was both shocked at the expense and amazed that Art would be willing to pay that for 3 months, nearly $12,000. She stared at him, open-mouthed.
It's worth it, he whispered.
That's crazy.
She repeated this later as he drove her to her mother's.
You can't think of it the same way you think of rent, Art replied. It includes food, the apartment, a 24-hour nurse, help with medication, laundry.
Right, and a very expensive orchid. I can't let you pay that, not for 3 months.
It's worth it, he told her again.
Ruth exhaled heavily.
Listen, I'll pay half, and if it works out, I'll pay you back. We already went through this. No halves, and there's nothing to pay back. I have some money saved, and I want to do this. And I don't mean it as a condition for us getting back together or getting rid of your mother or any of that. It's not a condition for anything. It's not pressure for you to make a decision one way or the other. There are no expectations, no strings attached.
Well, I appreciate the thought, but it's more than a thought. It's a gift. You have to learn to take them sometimes, Ruth. You do yourself wrong when you don't.
What are you talking about? the way you want something from people, some kind of proof of love or loyalty or belief in you, but you expect it won't come. And when it's handed to you, you don't see it, or you resist, refuse. I do not. You're like someone who has cataracts and wants to see, but you refuse to have an operation because you're afraid you'll go blind. You'd rather go blind slowly than take a chance. And then you can't see that the answer is right in front of you. That's not true, she protested. Yet she knew there was some validity to what Art was saying. It was not exactly right, but parts of it were as familiar as the tidal wave in her dreams. She turned. Have you always thought this of me? Not in so many words. I didn't really think about it until these past few months you've been gone. And then I started wondering if what you said about me was true. I realized I am self-centered and that I'm used to thinking about me first. But I also realized that you tend to think about you second. It's as though I had permission from you to be less responsible. I'm not saying it's your fault, but you have to learn to take back. Grab when it's offered. Don't fight it. Don't get all tense thinking it's complicated. Just take it, and if you want to be polite, say thank you. Ruth was tumbling in her head. She was being swept and tossed, and she was scared. Thank you, she finally said. To Ruth's surprise, her mother seemed to have no objection to staying at Miramar Manor. Then again, why would she? Lu Ling thought it was temporary and free. After she had toured the place, Ruth and Art took her to a nearby deli to have lunch and hear her reactions. So many old people have radon leak, she murmured with awe. Actually, not all of them are staying there because of radon leaks, Art said. Ruth wondered where this was leading to. Oh, other problem their house? No problem at all. They just like living there. Lu Ling snorted. Why? Well, it's comfortable, convenient. They have plenty of company. In a way, it's like a cruise ship. Lu Ling's face broke into a look of disgust. Cruise ship? Gao Ling always want me go cruise ship. You too cheap, she tell me. I'm not cheap. I poor. I don't have money throw in ocean. Ruth felt Art had blown it. Cruise ship. If he had been listening to her mother's complaints these last few years, he'd have known this was precisely the wrong comparison to make. Who can afford cruise ship? Her mother groused. A lot of people find staying at the Miramar cheaper than living at home, Art said. One of Lu Ling's eyebrows rose. How cheap? About $1,000 a month. Thousand? Ay-yah, too much. But that includes housing, food, movies, dancing, utilities, and cable TV. That's thrown in for free. Lu Ling did not have cable TV. She often talked about getting it, but changed her mind when she found out how much it cost. Chinese channel, too? Yep, several of them. And there are no property taxes. That also captured Lu Ling's interest. Her property taxes were in fact low, stabilized by a state law that protected the holdings of the elderly. Nonetheless, each year when Lu Ling received her tax bill, the sum seemed agonizingly huge to her. Art went on. Not all the units are $1,000 a month. Yours is more expensive because it's the number one unit, the best view, top floor. We're lucky that we got it for free.
Ah, best unit.
Number one, Art emphasized. The smaller units are cheaper. Honey, what did Mr. Patel say they were?
Ruth was taken by surprise. She pretended to recollect.
I think he said 750. That how much I get Social Security, Lu Ling said smugly.
And Art added,
Mr. Patel also said people who eat less can get a discount.
I eat less, not like American people, always take big helping.
You'd probably qualify then. I think you're supposed to weigh less than 120 pounds.
No, Art, Ruth interrupted. He said the cutoff was 100.
I only 85.
Anyway, Art said offhandedly, someone like you could live in the number one unit for the same as what you get each month for Social Security. It's like living there for free.
As they continued with lunch, Ruth could see her mother's mind adding up the free cable TV, the big discounts, the best unit, all irresistible concepts. When Lu Ling next spoke, she gloated.
Probably Gao Ling think I got lots money live this place, just like cruise ship.
They were celebrating Auntie Gal's 77th birthday, her 82nd, if the truth be known. But only she, Lu Ling, and Ruth knew that. The young clan was gathered at Gao Ling and Edmund's ranch-style house in Saratoga. Auntie Gao was wearing a silk flower lei and a hibiscus-patterned muumuu, in keeping with the luau theme of the party. Uncle Edmund had on an aloha shirt printed with ukuleles. They had just returned from their 12th cruise to the Hawaiian Islands. Lu Ling, Art, Ruth, and various cousins were sitting poolside in the backyard, or lanai, as Auntie Gal referred to it, where Uncle Edmund had fired up a grill to barbecue enough slabs of spare ribs to give everyone indigestion. The outdoor gas-fueled tiki torches were wafting warmth, making the outdoors seem balmy. The kids weren't fooled. They decided the pool was too cold and improvised a game of soccer on the lawn. Every few minutes they had to use the long-handled net to fish the ball out of the water.
"Too much splash," Lu Ling complained.
When Gao Ling went to the kitchen to prepare the last side dishes, Ruth followed. She had been waiting for an opportunity to talk to her aunt privately.
"Here's how you make tea eggs," Auntie Gal said, as Ruth shelled the hard-boiled eggs. "Use 2 big pinches black tea leaves. It must be black, not Japanese green, and not the herbal kind all you kids like to drink for health purposes. Put the leaves in the cheesecloth, tie it tight. Now put these cooked eggs in the pot with the tea leaves, 1/2 cup soy sauce for 20 eggs, and 6-star anise," Gao Ling continued. She sprinkled the mixture with liberal amounts of salt.
Her longevity was obviously a tribute to her genetics and not her diet.
"Cook for 1 hour," she said, and set the pot on the stove to simmer. "When you were a little girl, you loved to eat these. Lucky eggs, we called them. That's why your mommy and I made them. All the kids like them better than anything else. One time, though, you ate 5 and got very sick. Big mess all over my sofa. After that, you said, 'No eggs, no more eggs.' You wouldn't eat them the next year either, not you. But the year after that, eggs were okay again. Yum, yum."
Ruth didn't remember any of this and wondered whether Gao Ling was confusing her with her daughter. Was her aunt also showing signs of dementia? She went to the refrigerator and took out a bowl of scalded celery, cut into strips. Without measuring, she doused the celery with sesame oil and soy sauce, chatting as if she were on a talk show for cooks.
"I've been thinking one day I might write a book. The title is this, Culinary Road to China. What do you think, good? Easy recipes. Maybe if you're not too busy, you can help me write it. I don't mean for free, though. Of course, most of the words are already in my head, right here. I just need someone to write them down. Still, I'd pay you. Doesn't matter that I'm your auntie."
Ruth did not want to encourage this line of thinking.
"Did you make those same eggs when you lived in the orphanage with Mom?"
Gao Ling stopped stirring. She looked up.
"Ah, your mother told you about that place."
She tasted a piece of celery and added more soy sauce.
"Before, she never wanted to tell anyone why she went to the orphan school."
Gao Ling paused and pursed her lips, as if she had already divulged too much.
"You mean that precious auntie was her mother?"
Gao Ling clucked her tongue.
"Ah, so she told you. Good, I'm glad. Better to tell the truth."
"I also know both you and Mom are 5 years older than what we always thought, and that your real birthday is, what, 4 months earlier?" Gao Ling tried to laugh, but she also looked evasive.
"I always wanted to be honest, but your mommy was afraid of so many things. Oh, she said the authorities would send her back to China if they knew she wasn't my real sister, and maybe Edwin wouldn't marry her because she was too old. Then later you might be ashamed if you knew who your real grandmother was, unmarried, her face ruined, treated like a servant. Me? Over the years, I've become more modern thinking. Old secrets? Here, nobody cares. Mother not married? Oh, just like Madonna. But still, your mommy said, 'No, don't tell, promise.'
Does anyone else know? Uncle Edmund, Sally, Billy?"
"No, no, no one at all. I promised your mother. Of course, Uncle Edmund knows. We don't keep secrets. I tell him everything. Well, the age part, he doesn't know, but I wasn't lying. I forgot. It's true. I don't even feel like I'm 77. In my mind, the most is 60. But now you remind me, I'm even older. How old?"
82. Wow. Her shoulders slumped as she pondered this fact. 82. It's like less money in the bank than I thought.
You still look 20 years younger. Mom does, too. And don't worry, I won't tell anyone, not even Uncle Edmund. Funny thing is, last year when she told the doctor she was 82, I thought that was a sure sign something was wrong with her mind. And then it turned out she did have Alzheimer's, but she was right all along about her age. She just forgot to lie.
Not lying, Galen corrected. It was a secret.
That's what I meant. And I wouldn't have known her age until I read what she wrote.
She wrote this down? About her age?
About a lot of things. A stack of pages this thick. It's like her life story, all the things she didn't want to forget. The things she couldn't talk about. Her mother, the orphanage, her first husband, yours.
Auntie Gail looked increasingly uncomfortable. When did she write this?
Oh, it must have been 7, 8 years ago, probably when she first started worrying that something was wrong with her memory. She gave me some of the pages a while back, but it was all in Chinese, so I never got around to reading them. A few months ago, I found someone to translate.
Why didn't you ask me?
Gelling pretended to be insulted.
I'm your auntie. She's my sister. We are still blood related, even though we don't have the same mother.
The truth was, Ruth had feared her mother might have written unflattering remarks about Gao Ling, and it occurred to her now that Gao Ling might have also censored the parts that dealt with her own secrets, her marriage to the opium addict, for instance.
I didn't want to bother you, Ruth said.
Her aunt sniffed.
What are relatives for if you can't bother them?
That's true.
You call me any time, you know this. You want Chinese food, I cook for you. Translate Chinese writing, I can do this too. You need me to watch your mommy, no need ask, just drop her off.
Actually, remember how we talked about Mom's future needs? Well, Art and I looked at a place, Miramar Manor. It's assisted living, really nice. They have staff 24 hours a day, activities, a nurse who helps with medication. Gao Ling frowned.
How can you put your mommy in a nursing home? No, this is not right.
She clamped her mouth shut and shook her head.
It's not what you think. Don't do this. If you can't take care of your mommy, let her come live here with me.
Ruth knew that Gao Ling was barely able to handle Lu Ling for a couple of days at a time.
Nearly gave me a heart attack, was how she had described Lu Ling's last visit.
Still, Ruth was ashamed that her aunt saw her as neglectful, uncaring. All the doubt she had about the Miramar bobbed to the surface, and she felt unsteady about her intentions. Was this really the best solution for her mother's safety and health, or was she abandoning her mother for convenience' sake? She wondered whether she was simply going along with Art's rationale, as she had with so many aspects of their relationship. It seemed she was always living her life through others, for others.
"I just don't know what else to do," Ruth said, her voice full of the despair she had kept pent up.
"This disease, it's awful. It's progressing more quickly than I thought. She can't be left alone. She wanders away, and she doesn't know if she's eaten 10 minutes ago or 10 hours ago. She won't bathe by herself. She's afraid of the faucets."
"I know, I know. Very hard, very sad. That's why I'm saying you can't take it anymore. You just bring her here. Part-time my place, part-time your place. Easier that way."
Ruth ducked her head. Mom already went for a tour of the Miramar. She thought it was nice, like a cruise ship. Gao Ling gave a doubting sniff. Ruth wanted her aunt's approval. She also sensed that Gao Ling wanted her to ask for it. She and her mother had taken turns protecting each other. Ruth met Gao Ling's eyes. "I won't make any decisions until you think it's the right thing, but I would like you to look at the place, and when you do, I can give you a copy of what Mom wrote." That got Gao Ling's interest. "Speaking of which," Ruth went on, "I was wondering whatever happened to those people you and Mom knew in China. Mom didn't say anything about her life after she left Hong Kong. What happened to that guy you were married to, Funan, and his father? Did they keep the ink shop?" Gao Ling looked to the side to make sure no one was close enough to hear.
"Those people were awful," she made a face. "So bad you can't even imagine how bad. The son had many problems. Did your mother write about this?" Ruth nodded. He was hooked on opium. Gowling looked momentarily taken aback, realizing that Lu Ling had been thorough in her account.
This is true, she conceded. Later he died, maybe in 1960, though no one is sure for sure. But that was when he stopped writing and calling different people, threatening this and that to get them to send money.
Uncle Edmund knows about him?
Gowling huffed. How could I tell him that I was still married? Your uncle would then question if we were really married, if I am a bigamist, if our children are, well, like your mother. Later I forgot to tell him, and when I heard my first husband was probably dead, it was too late to go back and explain what should be forgotten anyway. You understand.
Like your age.
Exactly. As for the Chang father, well, in 1950, the communists cracked down on all the landlords. They put the Chang father in jail and beat a confession from him for owning many businesses, cheating people and trading in opium. Guilty, they said, and shot him, public execution.
Ruth pictured this. She was against the death penalty in principle, but felt a secret satisfaction that the man who had caused her grandmother and mother so much misery had met a fitting end.
The people also confiscated his house, made his wife sweep the streets, and all his sons were sent to work outdoors in Wuhan, where it's so hot most people would rather bathe in a vat of boiling oil than go there. My father and mother were glad they were already poor and didn't have to suffer that kind of punishment.
And Sister Yu, Teacher Pan, did you hear from them?
My brother did. You know, Juju in Beijing. He said Sister Yu was promoted many times until she was a high-position Communist Party leader. I don't know her title, something to do with good attitude and reforms. But during the Cultural Revolution, everything got turned around, and she became an example of bad attitude because of her background with the missionaries. The revolutionaries put her in jail for a long time and treated her pretty hard. But when she came out, she was still happy to be a communist. Later, I think she died of old age.
And Teacher Pan?
Jiujiu said the country one year held a big ceremony for the Chinese workers who helped discover Peking Man. The newspaper article he sent me said Pan Kaijing, the one your mother married, died as a martyr protecting the whereabouts of the Communist Party. And his father, Teacher Pan, was present to receive his Honorable Mention Award. After that, I don't know what happened to Teacher Pan. By now he must be dead. So sad. We once were like family. We sacrificed for each other. Sister Yu could have come to America, but she let your mommy and me have this chance. That's why your mommy named you after Sister Yu.
I thought I was named after Ruth Grudoff.
Her, too. But your Chinese name comes from Sister Yu, Yu Lu Yi. Lu Yi means all that you wish.
Ruth was amazed and gratified that her mother had put so much heart into naming her. For most of her childhood, she had hated both her American and her Chinese names, the old-fashioned sound of Ruth, which her mother could not even pronounce, and the way Lu Yi sounded like the name of a boy, a boxer, or a bully.
Did you know your mommy also gave up her chance to come to America so I could come first?
Sort of. She dreaded the day Gowling would read the pages describing how she had wangled her way to the States.
Many times I've thanked her, and always she said, "No, don't talk about this, or I'll be mad at you." I've tried to repay her many times, but she always refused. Each year we invite her to go to Hawaii. Each year she tells me she doesn't have the money.
Ruth nodded. How many times she had to suffer listening to her mother complain about that.
Each time I tell her, "I'm inviting you. What money do you need?" Then she says, "She can't let me pay. Forget it." So I tell her, "Use the money in the Charles Schwab account." "No, she doesn't want that money. She still won't use it."
"What Charles Schwab account?"
"This she didn't tell you? Her half of the money from your grandparents when they died."
"I thought they just left her a little bit."
"Yes, that was wrong of them to do. Very old-fashioned. Made your mommy so angry. That's why she wouldn't take the money, even after your Uncle Edmund and I said we would divide it in half anyway. Long time ago, we put her half in T-bills.
Your mommy always pretended she didn't know about it. But then she'd say something like, I hear you can make more money investing in the stock market. So we opened a stock market account. Then she said, I hear this stock is good, this one is bad. So we knew to tell the stockbroker what to buy and sell. Then she said, I hear it's better to invest yourself, low fees. So we opened a Charles Schwab account.
A chill ran down Ruth's arm. Did some of those stocks she mentioned include IBM, U.S. Steel, AT&T, Intel? Gelling nodded.
Too bad Uncle Edmund didn't listen to her advice. He was always running after this IPO, that IPO.
Ruth now recalled the many times her mother had asked Precious Auntie for stock tips via the sand tray. It never occurred to her that the answers mattered that much, since her mother didn't have any real money to gamble with. She thought Lu Ling followed the stock market the way some people followed soap operas. And so when her mother presented her with a choice of stocks, Ruth chose whatever was the shortest to spell out. That was how she decided. Or had she? Had she also received nudges and notions from someone else?
So the stocks did well? Ruth asked with a pounding heart. Better than S&P, better than Uncle Edmund. She's like a Wall Street genius. Every year it's grown and grown. She hasn't touched one penny. She could have gone on lots of cruises, bought a fancy house, nice furniture, big car. But no, I think she's been saving it all for you. Don't you want to know how much?
Ruth shook her head. This was already too much. Tell me later. Instead of feeling excited about the money, Ruth was hurt to know that her mother had denied herself pleasure and happiness. Out of love, she had stayed behind in Hong Kong, so Gowling would have a chance at freedom first. Yet she would not take love back from people. How did she become that way? Was it because of Precious Auntie's suicide? By the way, Ruth now thought to ask, what was Precious Auntie's real name?
Precious Auntie?
Balbo Mu.
Oh, Balbo Mu.
You know, only your mother called her that. Everyone else called her Bao Mu. What's the difference, Balbo Mu and Bao Mu?
Bao means precious, or it can mean protect. Both are third tone, Bao, and the Mu part, that stands for mother. But when it's written in Bao Mu, the Mu has an extra piece in front so that the meaning is more of a female servant. Bao Mu is like saying babysitter, nursemaid. And the Bo Mu, that's auntie. I think her mother taught her to say and write it this way, more special.
So what was her real name? Mom can't remember and it really bothers her.
I don't remember either. I don't know.
Ruth's heart sank. Now she would never know. No one would ever know the name of her grandmother. She had existed, and yet without a name, a large part of her existence was missing, could not be attached to a face, anchored to a family.
We all called her Bao Mu, Gowling went on. Also lots of bad nicknames because of her face. Burnt wood, fried mouth, that sort of thing. People weren't being mean. The nicknames were a joke. Well, now that I think of this, they were mean, very mean. That was wrong.
It pained Ruth to hear this. She felt a lump growing in her throat. She wished she could tell this woman from the past, her grandmother, that her granddaughter cared, that she, like her mother, wanted to know where her bones were.
The house in Immortal Heart, Ruth asked, is it still there?
Immortal Heart?
Oh, you mean our village. I only know the Chinese name.
She sounded out the syllables.
Xian Xin. Yes, I guess that's how it might translate. That's a mortal's heart, something like that. Anyway, the house is gone, my brother told me. After a few drought years, a big rainstorm came. Dirt washed down the mountain, flooded the ravine, and crumbled the sides. The earth holding up our house broke apart and fell bit by bit. It took with it the back rooms, then the well, until only half the house was left. It stood like that for several more years. Then, in 1972, all at once it sank and the earth folded on top of it.
My brother said that's what killed our mother, even though she had not lived in that house for many years.
So the house is now lying in the end of the world?
What's that? End of what?
The ravine. She sounded out more Chinese syllables to herself and laughed.
That's right. We called it that when we were kids. End of the world. That's because we heard our parents say that the closer the edge came to our house, the faster we'd reach the end of this world, meaning our luck would be gone. That was it. And they were right. Anyway, we had many nicknames for that place. Some people called it End of the Land, just like where your mommy lives in San Francisco, Land's End. And sometimes my uncles joked and called that cliff edge Momo Mayo, meaning rub, sink, gone. But most people in the village just called it the garbage dump. In those days, no one came by once a week to take away your garbage or recycling. No such thing. Of course, people then didn't throw away too much. Bones and rotten food. The pigs and dogs ate that. Old clothes we mended and gave to younger children. Even when the clothes were so bad they couldn't be repaired, we tore them into strips and weaved them into liners for winter jackets. Shoes, the same thing. You fixed the holes, patched up the bottoms. So you see, only the worst things were thrown away, the most useless. And when we were little and bad, our parents made us behave by threatening to throw us in the ravine, as if we too were the most useless things. When we were older and wanted to play down there, then it was a different story. Down there, they said, was everything we were afraid of. Bodies? Bodies, ghosts, demons, animal spirits, Japanese soldiers, whatever scared us. Were bodies really thrown in there? Gelling paused before she answered. Ruth was sure she was editing a bad memory. Things were different then. You see, not everyone could afford a cemetery or funeral. Funerals, those cost 10 times more than weddings. But it wasn't just cost. Sometimes you couldn't bury someone for other reasons. So to put a body down there, well, this was bad, but not the same way you think, not as though we didn't care about who died.
What about Precious Auntie's body?
Ay-ya, your mummy wrote everything.
Yes, that was very bad what my mother did. She was crazy when she did that, afraid that Bao Mu put a curse on her whole family. After she threw the body in there, a cloud of black birds came. Their wings were big, like umbrellas. They nearly blocked out the sun. There were so many. They flapped above, waiting for the wild dogs to finish with the body. And one of our servants,
old cook.
Yes, old cook. He was the one who put the body there. He thought the birds were Bao Mu's spirit and her army of ghosts, and that she was going to pick him up with her claws and snatch him up if he did not bury her properly. So he took a large stick and chased the wild dogs away. And the birds stayed there above him, watching as he piled rocks on top of her body. But even after he did that, our household was still cursed.
You believed that?
Gowling stopped to think.
I must have. Back then I believed whatever my family believed. I didn't question it. Also, old cook died only 2 years later.
And now? Gowling was quiet for a long time.
Now I think Bao Mu left a lot of sadness behind. Her death was like that ravine. Whatever we didn't want, whatever scared us, that's where we put the blame.
Dory flew into the kitchen.
Ruth, Ruth, come quick. Waipo fell in the pool. She almost drowned.
By the time Ruth reached the backyard, Art was carrying her mother up the steps of the shallow end. Luling was coughing and shivering. Sally ran from the house with a pile of towels.
Wasn't anyone watching her?
Ruth cried, too upset to be more tactful. Luling looked at Ruth as though she were the one being chastised.
Hiya, so stupid.
We're okay, Art told Luling in a calming voice. Just a little whoopsie-daisy, no harm done.
She was only 10 feet away from us, Billy said. Just walked in and sank before we knew it. Art dove in, beer and all, as soon as it happened.
Ruth swaddled her mother in towels, rubbing her to stimulate her circulation.
I saw her down there, Luling moaned in Chinese between more coughs. She asked me to help her out from under the rocks. Then the ground became sky and I fell through a rain cloud, down, down, down.
She turned to point to where she saw the phantom. As Ruth glanced where her mother gestured, she saw Auntie Gal, her face stricken with new understanding.
Ruth left her mother at Auntie Gal's and spent the next day at her house sorting out what should be moved to Miramar Manor. On the take list, she included most of her mother's bedroom furniture and the linens and towels Lu Ling had never used. But what about her scroll paintings, the ink and brushes? Her mother might feel frustrated looking at these emblems of her more agile self. One thing was for certain, Ruth was not moving the vinyl Lazy Boy. That was destined for the dump. She would buy her mother a new recliner, a much nicer one, with supple burgundy leather. Just thinking about this gave Ruth pleasure. She could already envision her mother's eyes aglow with wonder and gratitude, testing the squishiness of the cushion, murmuring, "Oh, so soft, so good." In the evening, she drove to Bruno's supper club to meet Art. Years before, they often went there as prelude to a romantic night. The restaurant had booths that allowed them to sit close and fondle each other. She parked around the corner a block away, and when she looked at her watch, she saw she was 15 minutes early. She did not want to appear too eager. In front of her was the Modern Times bookstore. She went in. As she often did in bookstores, she headed to the remainder table, the bargains marked down to $3.98, with the lime-green stickers that were the literary equivalent of toe tags on corpses. There were the usual art books, biographies, and tell-alls of the famous for 15 minutes. And then her eyes fell on the Nirvana Wide Web, Connections to a Higher Consciousness. Ted, the Internet spirituality author, had been right. His was a time-sensitive topic. It was already over. She felt the thrill of guilty glee. On the fiction table were an assortment of novels, most of them contemporary literary fiction, by authors not well known by the masses. She picked up a slim book that lay obligingly in her hands, inviting her to cradle it in bed under a soft light. She picked up another, held it, skimmed its pages, her eye and imagination plucking a line here and there. She was drawn to them all, these prisms of other lives and times, and she felt sympathetic, as if they were dogs at the animal shelter, abandoned without reason, hopeful that they would be loved still. She left the store carrying a bag with 5 books. Art was sitting in the bar at Bruno's, a retro expanse of 50s glamour. "You're looking happy," he said. "Am I?" She was instantly embarrassed. Lately, Wendy, Gideon, and others had been telling her what she appeared to be feeling, that she seemed bothered or upset, puzzled or surprised, and each time Ruth had been unaware of any feelings in particular. Obviously, she was showing something on her face, yet how could she not know what she was feeling? The maitre d' seated them in a booth that had recently been redone in clubby leather. Everything in the restaurant had managed to stay as though nothing had changed for 50 years, except the prices and the inclusion of uni and octopus appetizers. As they looked over the menu, the waiter came with a bottle of champagne. "I ordered it," Art whispered, "for our anniversary. Don't you remember? Nude yoga, your gay buddy. We met 10 years ago." Ruth laughed. She had not remembered. As the waiter poured, she whispered back, "I thought you had nice feet for a pervert." When they were alone, Art lifted his flute. "Here's to 10 years, most of it amazing with a few questionable parts, and the hope that we'll get back to where we should be." He pressed his hand on her thigh and said, "We should try it sometime." "What?" "Nude yoga." A rush of warmth flooded her. The months of living with her mother had left her feeling like a virgin. "Hey, baby, want to come back to my place afterward?" She was thrilled at the prospect. The waiter stood before them again, ready to take orders. "The lady and I would like to begin with oysters," Art said. "This is our first date, so we'll need the ones that have the best aphrodisiac effects. Which do you recommend?" "That would be the Kumamoto's," the waiter said, without a change of expression. That night, they did not make love right away. They lay in bed, Art cuddling her, the bedroom window open so they could listen to the foghorns. "In all these years we've been together," he said, "I don't think I know an important part of you. You keep secrets inside you. You hide. It's as though I've never seen you naked, and I've had to imagine what you look like behind the drapes.
I'm not consciously hiding anything. After Ruth said that, she wondered whether it was true. Then again, who revealed everything? The irritations, the fears. How tiresome that would be. What did he mean by secrets?
I want us to be more intimate. I want to know what you want. Not just with us, but from life. What makes you happiest? Are you doing what you want to do?
She laughed nervously. That's what I edit for others, that intimate soul stuff. I can describe how to find happiness in 10 chapters, but I still don't know what it is.
Why do you keep pushing me away?
Ruth bristled. She didn't like it when Art acted as if he knew her better than she knew herself. She felt him shaking her arm.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. I don't want to make you tense. I'm just trying to get to know you. When I told the waiter this was our first date, I meant it in a way. I want to pretend I've just met you, love at first sight, and I want to know who you are. I love you, Ruth, but I don't know you, and I want to know who this person is, this woman I love, that's all.
Ruth sank against his chest. I don't know, she said softly. Sometimes I feel like I'm a pair of eyes and ears, and I'm just trying to stay safe and make sense of what's happening. I know what to avoid, what to worry about. I'm like those kids who live with gunfire going off around them. I don't want pain. I don't want to die. I don't want to see others around me die. But I don't have anything left inside me to figure out where I fit or what I want. If I want anything, it's to know what's possible to want.
In the first gallery of the Asian Art Museum, Ruth saw Mr. Tang kiss her mother's cheek. Lu Ling laughed like a shy schoolgirl, and then hand in hand they strolled into the next gallery. Art nudged Ruth and crooked his arm.
Come on, I'm not about to be outdone by those guys.
They caught up with Lu Ling and her companion, who were seated on a bench in front of a display of bronze bells hung in two rows on a gargantuan frame, about 12 feet high and 25 feet long.
It's like a xylophone for the gods, Ruth whispered, taking a seat beside Mr. Tang.
Each bell makes 2 distinct tones.
Mr. Tang's voice was gentle, yet authoritative.
The hammer hits the bell on the bottom and the right side, and when there are many musicians and the bells are struck together, the music is very complex. It creates tonal layers. I had the pleasure of hearing them played recently by Chinese musicians at a special event.
He smiled in recalling this.
In my mind, I was transported back 3,000 years. I heard what a person of that time heard, experiencing the same awe. I could imagine this person listening. A woman, I think, a very beautiful woman.
He squeezed Lu Ling's hand.
And I thought to myself, in another 3,000 years, perhaps another woman will hear these tones and think of me as a handsome man. Though we don't know each other, we're connected by the music. Don't you agree?
He looked at Lu Ling.
Beautiful, she answered. Your mother and I think alike, he said to Ruth.
She grinned back. She realized that Mr. Tang translated for Lu Ling as she once had, but he knew not to be concerned with words and their precise meanings. He simply translated what was in Lu Ling's heart, her better intentions, her hopes. For the past month, Lu Ling had been living at Miramar Manor, and Mr. Tang went several times a week to visit. On Saturday afternoons, he took her on outings, to matinees, to free public rehearsals of the symphony, for strolls through the Arboretum. Today it was an exhibit on Chinese archaeology, and he had invited Ruth and Art to join them.
I have something interesting to show you, he had said mysteriously over the phone. Very much worth your while.
It was already worth Ruth's while to see her mother so happy.
Happy.
Ruth pondered the word. Until recently she had not known what that might encompass in Lu Ling's case.
True, her mother was still full of complaints. The food at the Miramar was, as predicted, too salty. The restaurant-style service was so slow, food already cold when come. And she hated the leather recliner Ruth had bought her. Ruth had to replace it with the old vinyl Lazy Boy. But Lu Ling had let go of most worries and irritations. The tenant downstairs,
the fears that someone was stealing her money, the sense that a curse loomed over her life and disaster awaited her if she was not constantly on guard. Or had she simply forgotten? Perhaps her being in love was the tonic, or the change of scenery had removed reminders of a more sorrowful past. And yet she still recounted the past, if anything, more often, only now it was constantly being revised for the better. For one, it included Mr. Tang. Lu Ling acted as if they had known each other many lifetimes, and not just a month or so.
"This same thing he and I see long time go," Lu Ling said aloud as they all admired the bells. "Only now we older."
Mr. Tang helped Lu Ling stand up, and they moved with Ruth and Art to another display in the middle of the room.
"This next one is a cherished object of Chinese scholars," he said. "Most visitors want to see the ritual wine vessels, the jade burial suits, but to a true scholar this is the prize."
Ruth peered into the display case. To her the prize resembled a large wok with writing on it.
"It's a masterly work of bronze," Mr. Tang continued, "but there's also the inscription itself. It's an epic poem written by the great scholars about the great rulers who were their contemporaries. One of the emperors they praised was Zhou. Yes, the same Zhou of Zhou Kodian, where your mother once lived and Peking Man was found."
"The mouth of the mountain?" Ruth said.
"The same, though Zhou didn't live there. A lot of places carry his name, just like every town in the United States has a Washington Street. Now come this way. The reason I brought you here is in the next room."
Soon they were standing in front of another display case.
"Don't look at the description in English, not yet," Mr. Tang said. "What do you think this is?"
Ruth saw an ivory-colored spade-like object, cracked with lines and blackened with holes. Was it a board for an ancient game of Go? A cooking implement? Next to it was a smaller object, light brown and oval, with a lip around it, and writing instead of holes. At once she knew, but before she could speak, her mother gave the answer in Chinese. "Oracle bone." Ruth was amazed at what her mother could recall. She knew not to expect Lu Ling to remember appointments or facts about a recent event, who was where, when it happened. But her mother often surprised her with the clarity of her emotions when she spoke of her youth, elements of which matched in spirit what she had written in her memoir. To Ruth, this was evidence that the pathways to her mother's past were still open, though rutted in a few spots and marked by rambling detours. At times she also blended the past with memories from other periods of her own past. But that part of her history was nonetheless a reservoir which she could draw from and share. It didn't matter that she blurred some of the finer points. The past, even revised, was meaningful. In recent weeks, Lu Ling had related several times how she received the apple-green jade ring that Ruth had retrieved from the Lazy Boy.
"We went to a dance hall, you and I," she said in Chinese. "We came down the stairs, and you introduced me to Edwin. His eyes fell on mine and did not turn away for a long time. I saw you smile, and then you disappeared. That was naughty of you. I know what you were thinking. When he asked me to marry, he gave me the ring."
Ruth guessed that Gao Ling had been the person who did the introductions. Ruth now heard Lu Ling speaking in Mandarin to Art.
"My mother found one of these. It was carved with words of beauty. She gave it to me when she was sure I would not forget what was important. I never wanted to lose it."
Art nodded as if he understood what she had said, and then Lu Ling translated into English for Mr. Tang.
"I telling him, this bone my mother give me one."
"Very meaningful," he said, "especially since your mother was the daughter of a bone doctor."
"Famous," Lu Ling said.
Mr. Tang nodded as if he too remembered.
"Everyone from the village all around came to him, and your father went for a broken foot. His horse stepped on him. That's how he met your mother, because of that horse."
Lu Ling went blank-eyed. Ruth was afraid her mother was going to cry. But instead, Lu Ling brightened and said,
"Liu Xing. He call her that. My mother say he write love poem about this."
Art looked at Ruth, waiting for her to acknowledge whether this was true. He had read some of the translation of Lu Ling's memoir, but could not connect the Chinese name to its referent.
"It means shooting star," Ruth whispered. "I'll explain later."
To Lu Ling, she said, "And what was your mother's family name?" Ruth knew it was a risk to bring this up, but her mother's mind had entered the territory of names. Perhaps others were there, like markers, waiting to be retrieved. Her mother hesitated only a moment before answering.
"Family name Gu."
She was looking sternly at Ruth.
"I tell you so many times, you don't remember? Her father, Dr. Gu. She Gu, Dr. Daughter."
Ruth wanted to shout for joy, but the next instant she realized her mother had said the Chinese word for bone. Dr. Gu, Dr. Bone, Bone Doctor. Art's eyebrows were raised in expectation that the long-lost family identity had been found.
"I'll explain later," Ruth said again, but this time her voice was listless.
"Oh." Mr. Tang traced characters in the air.
"Gu, like this, or this?"
Her mother put on a worried face.
"I don't remember."
"I don't either," Mr. Tang said quickly.
"Oh, well, doesn't matter."
Art changed the subject. "What's the writing on the oracle bone?"
"They're the questions the emperors ask the gods," Mr. Tang replied. "What's the weather going to be like tomorrow? Who's going to win the war? When should the crops be planted? Kind of like the 6 o'clock news, only they wanted the report ahead of time."
"And were the answers right?"
"Who knows? They're the cracks you see next to the black spots. The diviners of the bone used a heated nail to crack the bone. It actually made a sound. Whack! They interpreted the cracks as the answers from heaven. I'm sure the more successful diviners were skilled at saying what the emperors wanted to hear."
"What a great linguistic puzzle," Art said.
Ruth thought of the sand tray she and her mother used over the years. She, too, had tried to guess what might put her mother at ease, the words that would placate, but not be readily detected as fraudulent. At times she had made up the answers to suit herself, but on other occasions she really had tried to write what her mother needed to hear, words of comfort, saying that her husband missed her, that precious auntie was not angry.
"Speaking of puzzle," Ruth said, "the other day you mentioned that no one ever found the bones of Peking Man."
Lu Ling perked up. "Not just man, woman, too."
"You're right, Mom. Peking woman. I wonder what happened to her. Were the bones crushed on the train tracks on the way to Tianjin, or did they sink with the boat?"
"If the bones are still around," Mr. Tang replied, "no one's saying. Oh, every few years you read a story in the paper. Someone dies. The wife of an American soldier, a former Japanese officer, an archaeologist in Taiwan or Hong Kong. And as the story goes, bones were found in a wooden trunk, just like the trunks used to pack the bones back in 1941. Then the rumors leak out that these are the bones of Peking Man. Arrangements are made, ransoms are paid, or what have you. But the bones turn out to be oxtails, or they are casts of the original, or they disappear before they can be examined. In one story, the person who had stolen the bones was taking them to an island to sell to a dealer, and the plane went down in the ocean."
Ruth thought about the curse of ghosts who were angry that their bones were separated from the rest of their mortal bodies. "What do you believe?"
"I don't know. So much of history is mystery. We don't know what is lost forever, what will surface again. All objects exist in a moment of time, and that fragment of time is preserved or lost or found in mysterious ways. Mystery is a wonderful part of life."
Mr. Tang winked at Lu Ling.
"Wonderful," she echoed.
He looked at his watch.
"How about a wonderful lunch?"
"Wonderful," they said. As Ruth and Art lay in bed that night, she pondered aloud over Mr. Tang's romantic interest in her mother. "I can understand that he's intrigued with her since he's done this work on her memoir, but he's a man who's into culture, music, poetry. She can't keep up, and she's only going to get worse. She might not even know who he is after a while."
"He's been in love with her since she was a little girl," Art said. "She's not just a source of temporary companionship. He loves everything about her, and that includes who she was, who she is, who she will be. He knows more about her than most couples who are married."
He drew Ruth closer to him.
Actually, I'm hoping we might have that. A commitment through time, past, present, future. Marriage.
Ruth held her breath. She had pushed the idea out of her head for so long she still felt it was taboo, dangerous.
I've tried to legally bind you in the past with ownership in the house, which you've yet to take.
That's what he had meant by a percentage interest in the house? She was baffled by the mechanisms of her own defenses.
It's just an idea, Art said awkwardly. No pressure. I just wanted to know what you might think.
She pressed closer and kissed his shoulder.
Wonderful, she answered.
The name! I know your mother's family name! Gowling was calling Ruth with exciting news.
Oh my God, what is it?
First you had to know what trouble I had trying to find out. After you asked me, I wrote Juju in Beijing. He didn't know, but wrote back that he would ask a woman married to a cousin whose family still lives in the village where your grandmother was born. It took a while to sort out, because most people who would know are dead. But finally they tracked down an old woman whose grandfather was a traveling photographer, and she still had all his old glass plates. They were in a root cellar, and luckily not too many were damaged. Her grandfather kept excellent records, dates, who paid what, the names of the people he photographed, thousands of plates and photos. Anyway, the old lady remembered her grandfather showing her the photo of a girl who was quite beautiful. She had on a pretty cap, high-neck collar.
The photo mom has a precious auntie.
Must be the same. The old lady said it was sad because soon after the photo was taken, the girl was scarred for life. The father was dead, the whole family destroyed. People in the village said the girl was jinxed from the beginning.
Ruth couldn't stand it any longer.
What was the name?
Gu.
Gu? Ruth felt let down. It was the same mistake.
Gu is the word for bone, Ruth said. She must have thought bone doctor meant Dr. Bone.
No, no, Gowling said. Gu as in gorge. It's a different gu. It sounds the same as the bone gu, but it's written a different way. The third-toned gu can mean many things. Old, gorge, bone. Also thigh, blind, grain, merchant. Lots of things. And the way bone is written can also stand for character. That's why we use that expression. It's in your bones. It means that's your character.
Ruth had once thought that Chinese was limited in its sounds and thus confusing. It seemed to her now that its multiple meanings made it very rich. The blind bone doctor from the gorge repaired the thigh of the old grain merchant.
You're sure it's goo?
That's what was written on the photographic plate.
Did it include her first name?
Liu Xing.
Shooting star?
That's Liu Xing. Sounds almost the same. Xing is star. Xin is truth. Liu Xin means remain true, but because the word sounds similar, some people who didn't like her called her Liu Xing, the shooting star.
The shooting star can have a bad meaning.
Why? It's confusing why. People think the broom star is very bad to see. That's the other kind, with the long, slow tail, the comes-around kind.
Comet?
Yes, comet. Comet means a rare calamity will happen. But some people mix up the broom star with the shooting star. So even though the shooting star is not bad luck, people think it is. The idea is not so good either. Burns up quick. One day here, one day gone. Just like what happened to Precious Auntie.
Her mother had written about this, Ruth recalled. A story Precious Auntie had told Lu Ling when she was small. How she looked up at the night sky, saw a shooting star, which then fell into her open mouth. Ruth began to cry. Her grandmother had a name.
Gu Liu Xin. She had existed. She still existed. Precious Auntie belonged to a family. Lu Ling belonged to that same family, and Ruth belonged to them both. The family name had been there all along, like a bone stuck in the crevices of a gorge. Lu Ling had divined it while looking at an oracle in the museum.
and the given name had flashed before her as well for the briefest of moments, a shooting star that entered the Earth's atmosphere, etching itself indelibly in Ruth's mind. Epilogue. It is the 12th of August, and Ruth is in the cubbyhole, silent. Foghorns blow in the night, welcoming ships into the bay. Ruth still has her voice. Her ability to speak is not governed by curses or shooting stars or illness. She knows that for certain now, but she does not need to talk. She can write. Before, she never had a reason to write for herself, only for others. Now she has that reason. The picture of her grandmother is in front of her. Ruth looks at it daily. Through it she can see from the past clear into the present. Could her grandmother ever have imagined she would have a granddaughter like her, a woman who has a husband who loves her, two girls who adore her, a house she co-owns, dear friends, a life with only the usual worries about leaks and calories? Ruth remembers how her mother used to talk of dying by curse or her own hand. She never stopped feeling the urge, not until she began to lose her mind, the memory web that held her woes in place. And though her mother still remembers the past, she has begun to change it. She doesn't recount the sad parts. She only recalls being loved very, very much. She remembers that to Babamu she was the reason for life itself. The other day Ruth's mother called her. She sounded like her old self, scared and fretful.
"Louis," she said, and she spoke quickly in Chinese. "I'm worried that I did terrible things to you when you were a child, that I hurt you very much, but I can't remember what I did."
"There's nothing," Ruth began.
"I just wanted to say that I hope you can forget, just as I've forgotten. I hope you can forgive me, because if I hurt you, I'm sorry."
After they hung up, Ruth cried for an hour. She was so happy. It was not too late for them to forgive each other and themselves. As Ruth now stares at the photo, she thinks about her mother as a little girl, about her grandmother as a young woman. These are the women who shaped her life, who are in her bones. They caused her to question whether the order and disorder of her life were due to fate or luck, self-determination, or the actions of others. They taught her to worry. But she has also learned that these warnings were passed down, not simply to scare her, but to force her to avoid their footsteps, to hope for something better. They wanted her to get rid of the curses. In the cubbyhole, Ruth returns to the past. The laptop becomes a sand tray. Ruth is 6 years old again, the same child, her broken arm healed, her other hand holding a chopstick, ready to divine the words. Balbomu comes, as always, and sits next to her. Her face is smooth, as beautiful as it is in the photo. She grinds an ink stick into an ink stone of Duan. "Think about your intentions," Balbomu says. "What is in your heart? What you want to put in others?" And side by side, Ruth and her grandmother begin. Words flow. They have become the same person. 6 years old, 16, 46, 82. They write about what happened, why it happened, how they can make other things happen. They write stories of things that are but should not have been. They write about what could have been, what still might be. They write of a past that can be changed. "After all," Balbomu says, "what is the past but what we choose to remember?" They can choose not to hide it, to take what's broken, to feel the pain, and know that it will heal. They know where happiness lies, not in a cave or a country, but in love, and the freedom to give and take what has been there all along. Ruth remembers this as she writes a story. It is for her grandmother, for herself, for the little girl who became her mother.
Copyright New Millennium Audio, 2000, a division of NM World Media, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.